Ready. Any of you outside while the cold front came through? I was outside when it just started to blow, and then temperatures started to drop about 10 degrees in about 3 minutes. And then it'll come rain, and tomorrow will be 50, and the weekend will be wet and cool. Back to April. We can all stay inside and study. That's what you're supposed to do. And then when exams are over, we can have nice weather again. I'm sorry, that's not what I wish for you. It's just the way the world works. Some leftover assignment fours are here. Assignment five is here. You can pick them up after class. I have a couple of strays. Email has been a little bizarre, but a couple of you were missing things, and I have them. I found them. They haven't been graded yet, but that's more for Julie's sake than yours. Yes. I'm sorry? Yes, 5 and 6 are both optional. 5 is too late anyway, so you've already exercised your option on that. 6 is optional. But I do want to point out that it is worth a potential 40 points. So the people who do it will have some portion of those points, and the people who don't won't. And that will spread out the distribution of total points. And I think we're up to 110 so far. Something like that. And then whatever the range is on assignment 6. And then the final exam will be at least 100 points, so it'll be possible to recover a lot on that. The eco exam, the first time was 40 minus however many you missed, unless you missed more than 5. The second time, I'm sorry, 50, thank you. 50 minus however you missed. The second time it was 40 minus your score if you passed. Third time, 30 minus your score if you pass. So the range on those is 25 to 50. 49. Did I make it a perfect? No. Julie will be here in a minute and she can answer all the questions. Yes. Not doing an optional paper is getting no points, yes. Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah. Is that not clear enough? Was it not clear enough? Okay. Total points. And you don't have to do them all. And I'll just take the totals as they fall. I'm anticipating a question that I hope Joy's not going to ask, but go ahead. I will, but I don't. The reason I don't is that we just finished them this morning and finished recording the scores about half an hour ago, and they're not entered in the program yet, so but I will report that. And I'll also have Julie calculate 4. I'll also give you the distribution of total points so far and the average, which may be useful. I was going to put the total so far before 5 up on the internet, and as some of you know, we don't have internet access this week, so everything has been slowed. I haven't been able to update the website, which I will do over the weekend, assuming that they get the internet back on. I'm not technologically sophisticated enough to use anybody else's equipment. I would have to transfer my files from my computer to somebody else's computer and find a scanner and... So, I don't love you enough to put myself through that. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to keep up with the email, which I also can't do in my office, and the dial-up at home is annoyingly slow. But I think I'm doing that. I think I'm catching up, keeping up with email, I hope. Okay, other questions? What a guy. He answers questions before they're asked. Okay. Yes? You're not penalized for not doing it. Other people are rewarded for doing it. That's spin. What makes it optional is that I'm not going to hound you if you didn't do it. And yeah. I'm not sure I heard something in the middle. There are some things you have to do. Just you have to do them. They're not optional. And taking the final exam is one. The exercises were one. And if you don't do them, you're not in the course, my perspective. So the things that are required, and the things that are optional within a system that uses total points, those are the things you do because you really want an A. And people who don't want an A are able to say, oh, I don't have to do that one. He's not going to hound me, and I'm not going to fail if I don't do it. I'm just not going to get the points. Okay. And the system is designed to let people make those choices rather than do half-assed work.
Delete that word.
And it's designed to let people who want the A's to do more work. So that's the way it's set up. Yeah. Every person is accumulating points. Okay. And you have the number of points that you accumulate. There is no out of. There's no out of. There are no percentages. It's only total points. Okay. And this happens in 5, too. There are no percentages. There's nothing about a percentage. There's only the points that you get for the work that you choose to do, and the better the quality of that, the more points you get on that particular assignment. The more assignments you do, the more points you're likely to get. The people who have the most points at the end get A's. And everybody who has at least 100 points at the end passes. and the rest of the grades are distributed along there. Okay. So there's no percentage at all. I know that some of you have absorbed a feature of the macro system, a consistency across settings, which is that if you get 92% of the possible points, you get an A. And if you get 84, somewhere between 84 and 91, you get a B. I'm not in that macro system. I don't play that game. That game is invalid. Statistically, it's invalid. So, wipe that one out. And the reason I chose to not use percentages is that everybody who does, with the exception of about two people on campus, is violating most of the important principles of test construction and assessment. Because to use percentages requires that you validate your exam and that you have a model for what percentage of students are going to get each grade. And since I could never accept a model, I've never found one that I liked that said, well, 12% of people should get A's and 27% should get B's. But can people do that? I just don't believe in it. So I don't do that. And validating your exam means that you use the same exam for large numbers of students over multiple classes, and they validate each item as being statistically related to the scores and grades that people get. So, Moses did not bring 92% as an A. It wasn't even on the third tablet, the one that he dropped, and it wasn't in the lecture that he listened to while he took those notes. Okay, enough on the grading. If you still have problems with it, I'll be happy to explain it more. But okay, we're in the interpretive stage of development. Explain the world and yourself and each other. All right, Filinski. Okay, I have my notes back, so I am in fact able to pick up where I left off before. And it was interesting to compare the notes that I had and the overheads that I intended to use on Monday that I didn't have access to with the ones that I made up. And it's interesting. I would have lectured somewhat similarly to do that. But let me go back to exactly where I left off last Wednesday, which was that I was going to tie the reading on goodness of fit and temperament to Galinsky and what she's talking about. And so I'm going back to that particular reading. And what I had said at the end of lecture a week ago was that there are complications that make things more complex to understand as children are changing and parents are attempting to create a reasonable microsystem and appropriate relationships with their particular children. And the two that I had cited as complications were temperament and gender. And I don't have a reading on gender for this particular course. I don't think most of that is strange to you. But I did want to elaborate on the notion of temperament because it's an important shaper of what goes on in the relationship with parents. And the chapter that you have is from a book by Chess and Thomas. The title of the book is Your Child is a Person. And Chess and Thomas in that book report research that they have done looking at the differences among infants and how those differences are carried over across time. And I chose the particular chapter called Goodness of Fit because it fits very nicely with the developmental perspective and is useful information for you to have about parenting. And by extrapolation, for those of you who are in education, you will have children who have different kinds of temperaments. And the challenge as a parent or as a teacher is to create a relation with the child that is not contrary to what the child is capable of doing. Often, parents have images of what their child is going to be like, which are contrary to the temperament that the child brings into the world. We all want the Gerber baby, but we sometimes don't get the Gerber baby. So the issue is that children have their own personalities. That's why Chess and Thomas called their book, Your Child is a Person. What they mean is that the person that your child is not determined by you at the beginning. And the child's responsiveness will be unique. They fall into patterns. But the parent has the responsibility to adapt and help the child not be hindered by the particular temperament that the child has. Yeah. Right. That's a nice example. The question is, what are the theories about what causes a child, or causes the differences among children? And many cultures assume temperament, and assume temperamental differences. That's why it's such a fascinating topic, because writers have been describing different temperaments among people for at least 3,000 years. And many cultures have developed ways of explaining why people have the differences among us. We don't actually know, and that's the honest answer. We do have some evidence that, like the variations in intelligence that Howard Gardner describes in his work on multiple intelligences, brains come in different models. And some brains are very good at dealing with spatial relations and not so good with math, and other brains are pretty good at dealing with verbal input and output, but not so good with kinesthetic, physical motion issues. And to some degree, those variations are probably genetic, because you do see similarities within families in the kinds of intellectual profiles that people have. And you also see similarity in temperament. So there appears to be at least some genetic basis for that. Two difficult parents, two people who have reactive, negative kinds of characteristics, and we do hope they marry each other. The problem is that their children are also likely to have those characteristics, and those are families that tend to have a good deal of conflict in them. Two easy parents are quite likely to have an easy child. Things get more complicated when you have parents who have different styles. I'm an easy guy. My mother says I was never a problem growing up. I never got in trouble. I was really good at hiding it when I did. My parents are both very easy in their temperaments. They're very adaptable. They're pretty laid back. They don't respond negatively to much of anything, and it was nice to get that. But that's really boring. Really boring. So I married a woman who had a difficult temperament. Much more exciting that way. That's my first wife. And we had kids who were temperamentally quite different. We had one of each. And they cross gender. And so our daughter, I would say, is quintessential easy child. The kind of kid who is easy to raise. It's just very easy to provide a good fit for an easy kid, because an easy kid is the kind who, when she's 12 months old, is sitting in her crib in the middle of the night, and she has incredible ear infections in both ears. You know, all you have to do is look in them, and you can see this kid really needs a big glob of antibiotic. And this is the kid who's sitting up whimpering because both eardrums are about to burst. And you walk in response to her whimpering in your sleepy state, and the easy kid goes, "Just so happy to see you." The difficult kid with the same earache is not whimpering. The difficult kid with half of that earache is not whimpering. That kid is shrieking at 12 months and wants you to change that earache now. And when you walk in, is going to increase the volume of the screaming to make sure that you get the point, that this needs to be dealt with now. And difficult kids go to the emergency room a lot sooner than easy kids. Okay, that's just an example. So, part of the answer is probably genetic. Part of it may be prenatal influences. Probably not whether you see a cat on a wall. Probably not eating cherry pie or any of the other things that some cultures come up with. But the brain is a self-organizing organ. The genes don't determine specifically how cells get proliferated and assembled and organized. Some of that is just happens by itself. And sometimes there are variations in the development of the organization of the brain that might be related to temperamental differences. So that's one prenatal possibility, that the brain is organizing itself and there may just be random variation. The second is hormonal influences, particularly stress hormones. And that gets to the possibility that parents who are under a good deal of stress may be more likely to have kids with a particular kind of intelligence or temperament or personality. But there's no direct evidence for that yet. What we do know is that there are a couple of temperamental characteristics which have both a genetic influence and are represented by brain differences even in the first year. The brains of kids who are going to be shy and inhibited are responding emotionally differently than kids who are going to be sociable. And that difference continues up into their 20s, which is the longest longitudinal data we have. So it looks like people are perhaps wired to respond more or less emotionally, more or less intensely to different kinds of stimuli, and that's what we may be referring to as temperament. We also probably have different activity levels, different immune systems. All of those may be contributing to differences among us. It's a great question. It's probably a Nobel Prize or at least a psychological achievement prize for the person who comes up with a really good evidence for the influences. We also do know that parenting during the first couple of years of life can influence how a kid manifests the temperament. So that's a relatively new set of data and an interesting thing to think about when you look at the notion of goodness of fit. Being a parent who can adapt the environment and expectations and guidance to the specific needs of the child, being that kind of parent, allows you to create a relationship which has less conflict in it and allows you to create expectations and molar activities and rewards and guidance that allow the child to deal with the world effectively. When there's a potential that the child will not deal with the world effectively. And two of the temperamental styles that have risk are, one is the difficult, negative, highly reactive kid who is likely to get into trouble, who's likely to have difficulty keeping friends, who's likely to get into difficulty in school, who's more likely potentially to become a delinquent and run into trouble with the law and have bad relationships with family members in adulthood. Those consistencies we have pretty good evidence for. The other one that runs risk is the potential for being shy and inhibited. If you push that characteristic, the emotional reactivity that makes one inhibited and fearful in new situations, if as a parent you encourage that reactiveness and the anxiety in new situations, the potential trajectory for that over time is to become socially anxious and then socially inhibited and avoiding new situations, and at the far extreme, a social phobic, a person who won't go into new situations, who won't leave the house. But that's the trajectory over time that parents and other people can support. Or you can help the child supportively and gently become less anxious in new situations. You can help the child develop techniques for reducing the anxiety. You can help the child enter new situations gradually and reduce the reactivity that the child is going to display. And therefore help the child be less fearful than otherwise might be the case. That latter experience would be a good fit. The parent is doing what is helpful to the child so that the child has the skills to deal with the environment as well as possible. The other parent, the option, and some parents do this with the kid who's reactive, is when the kid says, I don't want to do that, the parent forces the kid to do it and doesn't provide any guidance. The parent is actually increasing the anxiety by not teaching the child how to deal with the new situation. And some parents believe that if you take a kid who's tending to be inhibited and fearful of new situations, if you throw that kid in the situation, they'll get over it. That's a bad fit, because they don't get over it. They become very anxious, they become very fearful, and they're the ones who are likely to become social phobics, because the parents have traumatized them by having expectations that the kid can't possibly meet. So that's what Chess and Thomas mean by a bad fit. And in the stages of development, of child development that Galinsky is describing, in each stage you can see the potential for parents to nurture a child in a way that would be a good fit, or to nurture a child in a way that might create a problem. You can see parents, particularly in the authority stage, creating a good fit for a child, or a bad fit. A good fit with a difficult kid. The difficult kid is reactive, negative, and resistant to change. Those are the central characteristics. So you've got this three-year-old that you can see doesn't like the schedule changed. Kid has a routine, so you walk into the kitchen and tell the kid, you're not going to have time to finish your lunch, we've got to get in the car and go, we have to be there an hour before I thought we were going to go. The easy kid takes that information and says, can I take my lunch with me?
that's fine. So, you know, the world does these things, and you don't have any control over them. So an easy, adaptable, non-reactive kid says, okay, but can I take it with me? Or can I have something to eat in the car? And the frantic parent says, yeah, yeah, whatever you want. And the easy kid goes on, and life is fine. The difficult kid looks at you and says, no. I'm going to eat my lunch. That's what I'm doing. I'm not going to be interrupted. Says that in body language, and when you start to say, no, you can't do it, the kid says, whatever you've taught the kid to say, excuse me, I'm editing my language. Three-year-olds don't have that kind of language. But you've got a three-year-old who is now upset because you're changing the schedule and you're depriving him of finishing the meal that he was in the middle of, that he was dawdling over, because he was thinking about something else, and you've come in and done a 90-degree turn from what he was about. He's going to resist that. And the options, some of you have had difficult kids as siblings, or as a couple of you are, I suspect. So pretty soon you have lunch on the floor, and you have a kid who is absolutely not going in the car with you, period, and the kid is throwing a full-blown temper tantrum on the kitchen floor because you threw a monkey wrench into what he was expecting to have happen. How do you create a good fit? You anticipate, in the first place, that the child is going to have a negative reaction, so you head that off. If the schedule is going to change, you announce that gently, and you don't spring it on a kid quickly, and you don't expect an immediate response of compliance, because difficult kids are called difficult because they don't do that. They don't comply when you ask them to do things. So you create a good fit by announcing, we're going to have to leave earlier than I expected. We've got to be there an hour earlier, so I'm going to get everything ready for the car. Finish what you can, and when you get close to being finished, let me know and I'll get you in the car. So you've left the kids some control, and then you slide away. And the kids got questions, and you answer those questions calmly. And if you're lucky, the kid will grudgingly, talking about how terrible the world is, will go with you, and lunch doesn't get on the floor. But you have to anticipate the possibility of a negative reaction and not provoke it. It's also helpful with difficult kids as part of creating the good fit, to anticipate that the first reaction to anything new will be no. So that's a reflex. That comes out of nowhere except some misguided cell assembly in the kid's brain that causes anything new to be responded to but with no. And if you take that no seriously, then you're in deep trouble. So to create a good fit, you don't even listen to the no. Or you respond to it by saying, I know it's really difficult for you to accept chocolate instead of vanilla, but we don't have any vanilla. And I know you want ice cream, so we're going to have ice cream. And let's see what we can do to make ourselves think it's vanilla or whatever you want. And you give the kid the second and third chance to come to terms with the fact that he's not going to have what he wanted, but he's going to have something that's okay. So you just say, well, okay, if you change your mind, it's here. Okay. Kid says no to ice cream. You know the kid wants ice cream, but you've changed the flavors. You don't have what he asked for. So you can either say, great, then you don't get any ice cream. And the kid looks at you, and you're in for a rough afternoon when you do that, because you've annoyed and frustrated a kid who now wants to change his mind, and a bad fit parent isn't going to let the kid change his mind. No, you said no. You said you didn't want any. I'm sorry, we're putting it away. You can't have any now. We've got to go. That's creating a bad fit and setting the kid up for conflict, setting yourself up for conflict with you. the good fit parent doesn't take that no seriously.
Okay.
You don't take it personally. It says no. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll leave the ice cream out, and if you decide you want it, just let me know, and I'll dish it out for you. And would you like something on it? Since you can't have vanilla and have to have chocolate, is there some way we could dress it up? How would you like it? So you take the kid's no, and you just, there it goes. And think about the marital relationship where people escalate and conflict. Okay, that's a bad fit. In the parent-child relationship, the same sort of thing can happen. You can escalate with the kid who's reactive, or you can avoid the escalation and reward changing your mind and becoming cooperative, and then it's fine. Part of the difficulty in creating a harmonious microsystem is that kids come with temperaments, and some of them are difficult, and they grow up to be parents and have kids. And you can probably survive pretty well if you have two easy parents and a difficult kid, they'll work it out. But if you have a difficult parent and a difficult kid, then you're setting the stage for child abuse. And the difficult kid with a difficult parent who is creating a bad fit, that's the kid who gets abused. And it's the parent who's got a short fuse, is not adaptable, can't accept change, can't accept frustration, who creates a bad fit for a kid. And a difficult kid is likely to push those buttons more often than an easy kid will. So easy kids don't get abused very often. And easy parents don't abuse very often because they're not emotionally reactive. But the difficult parent takes the kid's no. The kid doesn't want chocolate, the kid wants vanilla. The difficult parent takes that and responds with another no. And quickly tells the kid he's an idiot or can't have any ice cream at all. So you're creating conflict, and the kid who's difficult is going to be responding to that, and then the parent's going to respond to that, and the use of fists is symbolic because they're hitting each other verbally and emotionally, and they will get into an escalation that becomes a test of wills that the child is going to win. Kids can hold out longer than parents in that. Okay. So, creating a good fit requires the parent to have a more differentiated and valid view of children. And you have to have the skills to adapt your expectations so that you can create a good fit. And Chess and Thomas, in that chapter that you have, argue that the kid isn't going to change his or her temperament. It's too much to expect a 1 or 2 year old to deliberately change to fit your characteristics and your expectations. It's the parent who have to create that microsystem. They're the responsible adults. They have to find a way to create a relationship that works, that's developmentally appropriate. You would think the comment is that when you don't respond to the kid's no, the child might then begin to take advantage of that, and you end up getting walked all over. If you encourage a child to walk all over you, you're not creating a good fit. You're abandoning the parental role. What you're doing is recognizing that that no is an unthinking no. It's not serious, and it's potentially dangerous. So you let it go, but you stay engaged with the child, and you create then a different situation for the child. The child is not going to get what isn't there. You can't be, and there are parents whose response is, great, I'll get in the car and I'll run to the store and I'll get you the vanilla ice cream so you won't have a temper tantrum. That parent is creating a monster. That kid will take advantage of that parent. And it's the parent's responsibility to be able to say, there isn't any vanilla, there's no way to get any, it's not going to happen. If you want the chocolate, you get the chocolate. I'll dress up the chocolate if you want. I'll give you a certificate that says you can have vanilla next week. You know, whatever it takes. What you're doing is giving the kid a more valid view, and along the way helping the child learn the skills that it's going, not the manipulative skills, but eventually the ability to inhibit that no. So that by the time the kid is 15, 25, somewhere along that span, that the kid recognizes that the first response is typically negative and that's not helpful. And so the goal is to have a kid who starts to respond like that and then says, oh, wait a minute, let me think about that. And so, yeah, okay, yeah, chocolate's fine. It's okay. But the kid has to become reflective enough to catch him or herself doing it. And the parent can help the child learn those skills, but that's a slow process. You know, when the kid does blow it and gets mad at you, you say, well, wait a minute, I asked you about ice cream, you blew your top, and we got into this thing that doesn't work. If you really thought about ice cream, is it worth having a temper tantrum because you can't have vanilla? And a reasonable child by 5 or 6 will say, no, okay. And then what you want is for the child to learn those skills of saying, okay, let's see, is it worth having a temper tantrum about chocolate or vanilla? No. So, okay, that's fine. And you reward that. You make sure that you understand that the kid has made a big achievement when the kid can stop herself from giving you that negative reaction. And that's a matter of teaching the kid to listen to himself or herself, and then to be able to say, oh, wait a minute, no. Yeah, I guess chocolate would be okay. But you don't let the kid walk all over you. You don't want to create a good fit by catering to the kid's every whim. Mm-hmm. Okay. The question is, what happens when the parent is dealing with the child, perhaps effectively, but the rest of the world doesn't? The mesosystem may have different expectations in other settings, and the possibilities you raise for grandparents who are either not going to take the kids no, grandparents can be abusive, or the grandparents who are going to bend themselves out of shape to cater to the child's every whim, and that's a grandparent's right to create monsters for their children to raise. You know, spoiling children, creating monsters is one of the things that grandparents have the right to do. We've earned it. On the other hand, it would be helpful if they were also reasonable about it. And then you have the necessity for communication between the parents and the grandparents about how you want the child to be dealt with. And you often have the reversal of roles of parents teaching their own parents how to deal with the grandchildren. And sometimes you have major family conflict about how you're dealing with kids. Another possible conflict is with teachers. Teachers often don't have the time or the I once heard of a teacher who didn't have the skill to provide a good fit for kids who were not easy to deal with. You heard what I just did. I just didn't talk about teachers generally. Some teachers don't have the wits or the skill or the patience or the time to deal with kids who don't fit their expectations. And then you have a kid who has a problem in school. So in those situations, what you're doing is seeing a mesosystem problem. The kid's in other settings, and the parents may be doing a pretty good job, but they're not getting support from other places. Sometimes you get the reverse. The teacher does a really great job with the kid, and the parents are still mucking it up at home with a bad fit. And you hope the kid has enough settings where she can create good relationships and develop skills in spite of the bad ones. Ideally, we would have good ones. And one of the things that literally psychologists spend a lot of time doing is helping teachers and parents figure out how to create a fit for a particular kid. Or finding other settings for kids when teachers can't, or when you can't do it appropriately. Was there anything else in that I didn't respond to? Okay, well, let's talk about gender a little bit, since that's one of the other complications. Parents have expectations for boys and girls. We all have expectations for boys and girls, even those of us who say we don't. And one of the realities is that boys and girls are a little bit different. Not a big difference at birth, but their brains may work somewhat differently because of the Y chromosome that bathes the male brain in androgens at about 8 weeks of age. And boy babies and girl babies are just enough different in their responsiveness and what they pay attention to that parents can see the difference and they respond to the differences even though they're very subtle and gradually accentuate those in many cases. Parents have different expectations for what boys will do and what girls will do. So they treat them differently. And the way they're treating the kids are creating relationships and expectations, different expectations in the microsystem, and eventually different characteristics for us as male or female. Not entirely due to the parents' behavior, but certainly aided and abetted by it in one direction or others. I don't want to get into the whole repertoire of differences between boys and girls, but the microsystem that parents create has different expectations and different responsiveness and typically encourages different molar activities for boys and girls. We do genderize our kids and we treat them, even when we think we're not going to, we treat them differently. Some of you have heard my tale of running into that myself with a daughter born first and a son born second, and absolute determination that we were not going to raise our children with any differentiation between them based on gender, that we were going to allow them to do everything and encourage them not to have any limits that were based on gender. And day two in the hospital with our son, he was lying on the bed, and I was sitting on the bed, and I caught myself taking his little fist in my hand. And what do you do with a fist? You bump the kid's nose with it. Right? He was a boy, so I did that. I never would have done that with my daughter. Never. It would never have occurred to me to do that. And at that point, I began to appreciate how deeply ingrained genderedness is and the expectations are for us. The fun thing is that my son has probably thrown two punches in his life and avoids fights like the plague. One of my daughter's major triumphs was in first grade, slugging the little boy who was harassing her with her lunchbox in the stomach on the way home from the bus and decking him. I loved it. And the bus driver applauded and thought the little boy had been asking for it. And then later in life, she was touring the pyramids in Egypt, and the people she was with had gone off to ride camels, and she was just walking around by herself at one of the pyramids, and a local resident she observed to be exposing himself to her sexually, and so she walked away, and he followed her, and he was talking to her, but in Arabic, so she didn't know what he was saying, or didn't know much of what he was saying. And she told him to get lost and kept on, but he touched her shoulder. She turned around and floored him. And so the only thing that she regretted was that he ducked just enough that she hit him in the chest rather than in the nose. And she had absolutely no qualms about clobbering him. So, I don't mess with her. She could carry me around the kitchen floor when she was in fifth grade. And I stopped arm wrestling with her when about that time. I don't like to get hurt. She wrote Heavyweight Crew, for those of you who wrote. And she could probably still... Well, I know she could because of her Aikido training. I'd never tangle with her now. She'd put me on my nose. So bumping my son's nose made him fearful of fighting. So it works. Okay. Is that the interpretation I can give? Parents are likely to talk with boys less. They're likely to help boys less. They're likely to cuddle girls more. They're likely to offer girls help more quickly. They're much more likely to talk with girls about feelings, about their own feelings and about other people's feelings, and they're more likely to encourage little boys to solve their own problems rather than asking for help. And you could go on with the list of things that parents do that differentiate. And fathers and mothers do different things with boys and with girls. So fathers treat kids differently than mothers do, typically, and that affects the relationships that they're able to create, the kind of molar activities they engage in, and the kinds of activities that characterize the microsystem that they're creating. So microsystems and relations with parents reflect temperament. They reflect gender. And in Dunn's article, the chapter that you have from Judy Dunn's book on siblings and family constellation, you will also read, if you haven't yet, about the effects of birth order on what kinds of experience kids are going to have in that microsystem and what they're going to construct from that experience. And we'll talk about that on Monday. But let me go back to Belinsky. Now, we were talking about the... Unless there are questions about genderedness. Okay, these are the overheads that I didn't have. We've already talked through this, but this is from Galinsky, the interpretive stage. which she says is roughly the school years, the elementary school years, and the parents' major task is to interpret the world to their children, and that entails not only interpreting themselves to their children and interpreting and developing their children's self-concept, but also answering their questions, providing them access to the skills and information they need, and helping them form values. So in this interpretive stage, Galinsky is focusing directly on the Muller activities and the validity and differentiation of the understanding of the world that the kid is going to be developing. In this interpretive stage, there's a strong emphasis on helping the kid create that differentiated view of the world and developing skills. And that means helping them understand you as a parent, themselves as kids, the world and how it operates, what boys and girls can do, perhaps even their own temperament during this period. And because the kids are becoming verbal and curious and experiencing more settings, parents are faced with more questions. If a kid has any spunk and intelligence at all, the kid can come up with all kinds of questions. We talked about that briefly on Monday. And what that does is present parents with questions that they've never thought about before. And they have to re-examine their implicit theories. The ones that I haven't really thought about, haven't really tried to put into words, but my kid is now asking me. And we talked about, among other things, where babies come from as an example of that. That process of being questioned by kids and having to come up with answers changes the parents. So you're creating a transaction that is forcing parents to reconsider their understanding. And there is a brand new book out that I have not read, but if anybody has seen it, I would love to find out more about it. And I'm not sure of the title, but it is something to the effect that parenting makes you smart. And as I understand the book, it's written by a woman who has looked at the demands that children make on parents. And her conclusion, from her own experience and then from interviews, I gather, is that trying to keep up with children and answer their questions and interpret the world for them increases parents' intelligence. If you run into that one or see reviews of it, I'd like to know more about it. I'll try to get it. Because it fits in nicely with the transactional view of parenting and suggests that the process is affecting the parents at the same time that it's affecting children. The themes that Galinsky talks about include interpreting children to themselves, helping them develop self-concept, separating and connecting with your children as you send them off to school, and finding new ways to be connected with them and with the settings that they're going into. When you send a child off to school, you're creating a mesosystem for yourself, you're creating a mesosystem setting for the family, and creating then the relationships with that setting and with the people in it. So you have to go back to school, literally, and figure out how now, as an adult, you're going to relate to teachers and other people in authority, because they have responsibility for your children, and you want to create congruence in your two settings. You're interpreting the world of the children, we've talked about, and interpreting the child to the world, helping the world understand what is going on with your child. You have to decide how involved you're going to be. As you think about writing rules for kids, one of the things that I've seen in the draft, rules for parents, I mean, is some of you who've given us drafts have talked about making the making activities available, creating a mesosystem for your child. And others have talked about doing things with the child. And there's a subtle difference, but a very important difference between that. Do you enroll your kid in soccer, or do you play soccer with your kid? Do you become the coach? Do you play with other kids? Are you involved? Is it a joint activity for you, or are you just making it available? Do you make sure your child has piano lessons or musical lessons? And that may be very important. Or do you play music at home with the child, or both? And are those different? I think they're different, and I think if the child has both of those, the experience is going to be different than if the parents send the kid off to music lessons but don't do anything about music in the home themselves. A classic expression of that difference is the advice to not send your kids to church, but take your kids to church. You make it a joint activity, you create a transcontextual dyad. And then in the interpretive years, you're also anticipating the next stage. And if you've spent much time talking to parents about what's going to happen during the teenage years, it can be fairly frightening. When I do parent education programs, one of the things that I hear regularly is how afraid parents are of what's going to happen when their kids become teenagers. And I've heard that in a number of situations where there were parents and children together, and the children are not yet adolescents, and the parents are saying to each other and to me that they're really not looking forward to when their kid becomes a teenager because of all the problems. So here's a kid who's 10, hearing the parents say, your teenage years are going to be a problem and I'm not looking forward to them. How do you feel? What kind of view of adolescence does the kid get? Adolescence is lots of fun as a parent. Great fun. Galinsky calls it the interdependent stage. Kids go through puberty, and everything changes. The child changes skills, the child changes potential, the child relates to everybody else differently, and the microsystem at home is going to be dramatically altered. Conversations are going to change. Let's start with some of the simple ones. As kids go through intellectual development, as they go into adolescence, they pick different fights with their parents. And the fights get much more intellectual. Kids are picking up on their parents' behavior, and they are, in fact, becoming their parents' equals intellectually. As you get into adolescence, you're using the same logic your parents are. You don't have the content, you don't have the experience, but the logic is the same. So kids start questioning their parents in new ways. And they start questioning whether the parent's view of the world is valid and whether the parent is being logical in the rules that the parent is enforcing, in the justifications the parents give for their own behavior and their expectations for the child. And kids become able to argue much more effectively as they become more equal. They're also becoming, because they're pubescent, they're becoming bigger and stronger. And one of the realities is that almost nobody spanks a 15-year-old. You may try once, because you just kind of forgot that the kid is bigger than you. But using physical force, which is very easy to use when a child is 2 or 3 or 4, you pick the kid up by the arm if you want, sit on the kid, whatever you want. We don't recommend it. But there is an inherent power differential between parents and children when kids are little. Puberty erases that power differential, and in many cases, take the physical power from the parent's hands to equality and then to putting it in the child's hands. As kids become able to out-arm wrestle their fathers or resist a parent's attempts. And some kids have physical fights with their parents and win in adolescence. Parents all know that that potential is there. They know that they can't go around hitting their kids. They can't force them to do things. So intellect becomes much more important, and moral persuasion. The problem with puberty is that parents' images of adolescence may not fit the experience that they're having. Most of us assume that our kids will become pubescent when they turn 13. But if you have an 8-year-old who's going through puberty, or a 9-year-old, that's normal, but it's not what you expect. I ran into that many years ago. We had neighbors when I was in Pittsburgh who had three daughters, and the oldest one was 10 going on 11 when we moved in next door to them. And one day the mother was, she'd found out that I was a child psychologist. You try to keep that from your neighbors if they have kids. But she found out I was a child psychologist, so she started grilling my wife about what kind of advice I would give them. And I finally, my wife said, why don't you just ask him? And so they came in and we were talking. And I'd been watching the kids play in the backyard. And this 10, almost 11-year-old was clearly pubescent. There was no doubt about it. Long legs, long arms. She was just on the verge. And the mother was having a great deal of difficulty with her and didn't understand her and thought there was something wrong with her. She was more emotional than she had been in the past, and she was picking fights with her little sister, and she was more resistant. And the mother was wondering, mother had it all figured out that this was because they had had the third child, who was at that time not quite a year. So they had 10 and 8 and little accident. And little accident was one of those really, really difficult, obnoxious little kids. She screamed a lot. And so mother was beating herself up because the presence of this baby, this was a baby who was conceived just before they got rid of all the baby stuff. Literally, they got rid of it. It all went away on a truck because they weren't going to have any more kids. And she didn't know that she was pregnant, but she was at the time. A great story. Don't get rid of it until your tubes are tied. And the mother was blaming the 10-year-old's mood and her resistance to having this obnoxious little baby. So she was really beating herself up about having gotten pregnant. And she, mother was convinced that it was ruining her daughter's life, and that for some, because she didn't want this child, she had this difficult temperament child. And I was able to relieve her part of the guilt by saying, I doubt that the baby is having much difficulty. You have a teenager. And she said, she's only 10. I don't care. Look at her. And the mother said, what? She can't be. She's not a teenager. You know? She is. Her body doesn't know that. And that if you look at her hands, you look at her arms, you look at her legs, that's puberty. And probably if you can get into the bathroom when she's there, when she's getting dressed, you'll find breast buds and pubic hair. And the mother thought I was crazy. And the mother came over that night, the very night, and said, you're right. Now what do I do? So I gave her a couple of books that weren't very helpful. The image of timing was her problem. It's not when you're a teenager. It's when it happens. And anywhere from 8 to 15 is just fine, depending on the genes that you got and your nutritional status. Parents also have images that the child won't change. We love our children. We love having fourth graders. They're just so great. They're wonderful kids. They're not going to become teenagers. And we resist the recognition of that. And then they change and they become people. And they become bigger than we are, and they become more powerful than we are. And they have more opportunities than we have. And there's a problem with the timing of puberty. If you have your kids in your late 20s or early 30s, and they go through puberty at a reasonable time, they're going through puberty and becoming beautiful and handsome and powerful and skilled, while you're beginning to slide down the hill of midlife. And that doesn't help the transactions when parents are thinking that they are in some ways better than their teenagers, than their kids, and the teenagers are every day demonstrating that they're passing you. It's an interdependent stage. There's a good question. Why is it an interdependent stage? The little kids are dependent on us. Okay. And then they try to become independent. And the teenagers are doing that. But where we're trying to go, interdependent. Yeah. Independence is that, two telephone poles standing independently. Dependence is when the kid leans on you. You know, the kid needs you for support. Then you become independent. And interdependence is actually the strongest structure. When two people depend on each other and support each other. Think about, as you review Galinsky, why she's calling this the interdependent stage rather than independent stage. And we'll go on from there Monday. Have a good weekend.
I'll put you on the web.